Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on July 7th, 2026. The time to convene the meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Julieta Alcamara Crosby, our Vice President, Commissioner Tony Oath, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO General Manager, Helen Willenbrock, our Chief Operating and Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stoltzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices at this time. So I'll begin with a flag salute if you would like to join me. I salute the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice. Copies of the agenda are located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda?
I have none.
Comments from the public is item two on the agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments that will be limited to 3 minutes. The person shall be recognized to speak. A sign up card is located at the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. If joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial star 9 by phone. I'll call on you to speak. Time. Calling in on a phone, you will need to dial star 6 once the time to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state your name, and indicate where you're from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioner and the audience. If you have documents or the materials mentioned for the record, hand them to the clerk for the board. Appreciate your cooperation with all the procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. So first off, we'll start off with item one, recognitions declarations. We have 1A, Employee of the Month, Jim Moore, with Michael Hill here who will be introducing. Good morning.
Good morning, commissioners. I have backup. So, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here today and to recognize someone whose work often is behind the scenes and has tremendous impact with the district. Employee of the Month honors employees who consistently go above and beyond, and today's recipient exemplifies what it means to serve others, support a teammate, and deliver outstanding results. However, I have to admit, for me, this is a little unusual. I've been with the district for about 5 months. So as you can see from the turnout in this room, there are probably many people who could talk about Shane's accomplishments and what he brings a lot better than I could, but we would probably be here for most of the day if we allowed them to do that. But I will say is that sometimes it doesn't take very long to recognize someone who's exceptional. It didn't take long for me to understand why Shane is so respected, why people genuinely enjoy working with him, and why he's so deserving of being recognized for this award. Shane is an engineer within our customer technology systems team, and he plays an incredibly important role supporting both our department and energy services for the programs that we deliver to our customers. Shane has been the driving force behind implementing and expanding our iEnergy platform. He partnered with our vendor to build the foundation of the system, and once that was transitioned in-house, he took ownership and continued his development. He has an incredible ability to take complex business needs and translate them into practical technology solutions that make it life easier for our employees, our trade allies, and ultimately our customers. While much of Shane's work happens behind the scenes, the results are visible every day. The systems and processes that he has developed make it easier for customers and contractors to participate in our programs, improve the experience of our employees, and help the district deliver those services more effectively and efficiently. One thing that stands out about Shane is that he never settles for simply getting the job done. He always is looking for ways to improve the process, simplify something that's complicated, or help someone solve a problem. As I read through the Employee of the Month nominations, one thing really stood out is that different people from different parts of the organization all describe the same person. The same themes appeared again and again. Someone is collaborative, dependable, approachable, innovative, and always willing to help. The thing that people most appreciate about Shane isn't just what he knows, it's how he's willing to share the knowledge that he has. If someone comes to him with a question, even outside his area of responsibility, he doesn't just point them somewhere else, he He helps them find the answer. He shares his expertise freely, encourages new ideas, and generally wants people around him to succeed. He makes those around him better. That's one of the greatest contributions anyone can make to an organization. I may have only known Shane for 5 months, but that's been more than enough to understand why so many people respect him, trust him, and enjoy working with him. He's made our team stronger. He's helped modernize the way we serve. And he's made our organization better. We're incredibly fortunate to have him as part of the Snohomish County PUD. I just want to congratulate Shane and thank him for everything he does for his teammates, for the customers, and for the district.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get out of that.
Where am I going, Sid? Talk me through this.
I hate up here.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, first off, thank you so much for all you do. You're obviously an amazing team member just by how you filled the room. And you brought babies.
Three and a half months. Freshies. Oh, yeah.
Hold on to the team beauty. Right?
Absolutely. That's right. Recruit me on.
Right. Building things that help other team members work through solutions and solve problems is wonderful. But building things that help our customers at all levels, it's just fantastic. So it really means a lot to us. So we appreciate you very much.
Thank you.
Say congratulations and thank you for what you do. Sometimes we are thinking that being behind the scenes, you never impact, but I really impact whatever thing that you do, we impact everything. Thank you so much.
Oh, here's old Tony with some questions.
Yes.
So feel the interfaces with, they said that they all work with the and translate what they need into something that is automated. Okay, got that part. Well, then, do you do source code stuff, or do you then
no,
go off?
It's all kind of like low code, no code stuff. So we're doing more of the like configuration. We have a platform that we like can take all of our like PDFs and Excel workbooks and translate them into an online experience with customers so that they can go out to my snowboard and just and apply straight from
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Wow. That's cool. Totally foreign to me. Do you ever work on the help desk?
I do not work on the help
desk. I'm looking for somebody. I'm looking for somebody on the help desk that when they come into life. Anyway, congratulations.
Well, we have a few things for you.
Knickknacks.
Trophy. Upgraded trophy. So if you have a trophy cape.
Oh, perfect.
Get one, but you're right. Okay. Be careful. You don't want these to fall on the little ones.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Trophy case it is that.
Yeah.
You don't just shoot a star one.
Okay. All right.
And yes, because, and then you
oh
can
my God. Yeah, young, youthful
oh,
guy.
Yeah. That's so nice.
Thank you so much.
And I get to get, I know that this is going up. Great. How about that?
Absolutely.
That's why a lot of diapers.
They go faster too, though.
Well, let's get a picture. So,
picture time.
I'll take these two and get these to Elsa. You hold her.
All right. Name.
Does everybody know the name of the Babettes?
The bets we've got Matilda and Jack.
Boy and
girl.
You're one of you.
My niece is Matilda too. Yes. 2 years old.
Oh. Thank you, Tony. Countdown or anything, huh? I hope her name's Tanya.
Are you? elite group.
W N Y A, so even
oh, you got a W.
Why? So, like,
right. So,
so a couple things. First, do you have any family here you'd like to introduce?
I would love to introduce this family. I've got my father, Jackson, my mother, Shelly, my youngest sister, Gabrielle, Ellie, my wife, Hannah, and my daughter and son, Jack and Matilda.
Mike, the three of us will step out of the way and you can have a family picture.
Yes, please. Awesome. Yeah, it's a smiley boy, smiley boy.
Going.
Are we strategically touching
right there? What?
3.5.
Yeah.
Like 14 weeks if we're counting by weeks.
How about being here?
Huh? I know.
Okay, ready?
Ready. Oh, yeah, thank you so much.
We got the team that be on him.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Shane, do you want to say a few words? You can. Open mic for.
You don't have to. I guess I just want to thank my team so much for this honor. I work with an amazing team. They make it so easy to come to work and do every day. It's really cool to work on a team who solves like complex and interesting challenges that are ultimately making our community more resilient. It's saving energy for our customers. It's saving energy for us. Yeah, it's a dream job, and I'm so grateful every day that I get to do this. So, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Good morning,
everyone. Of course, welcome to today. It's going to be an exciting meeting, but I feel like you have to. Yeah. Yeah. Next is item 2.
Breaking the baby.
Any comments from the public on topics not on today's agenda for public hearing? An opportunity to comment on public hearing items are scheduled for later in our agenda. Please state your first and last name for the record. Comments will be limited to 3 minutes. So I have no cards. Is there anyone in the room that would like to speak? And I'm not seeing any online. We'll move to item 3. It's always a good day when we have babies. We don't have to worry about it. So item 3, consent agenda. 3A, approval of the minutes of the regular meeting of June 23rd, 2026. 3B, bid award professional service contract amendment. 3C, consideration of certification / ratification and approval of district checks and voucher. I'll call for a motion. Are there any questions or comments, commissioners?
I have none.
Okay. I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Next is item 4, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. This item is for the board and our general manager to discuss issues among ourselves and the team staff. I'll introduce our general manager, John Hart, to the conversation. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioner. Lots of good stuff on the agenda today. We'll start with our media update and Aaron Twainy. Aaron.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Swaney, Manager for Communications. Would to follow up twin babies, which is great.
Talking about marketing, right?
Yes. Okay, so starting with battery energy storage, we've had some inquiries from media lately. Washington State Standard reached out to us. They were doing a larger story on battery storage, kind of talking about a lot of the projects PSE is trying to put into, like, Snoqualmie, Carnation, certain areas of Skagit County. We obviously came up because of our success with the Arlington project. It was a small mention, but I think we're going to be seeing more and more of these highly kind of controversial articles coming out on battery energy storage, and I think we have a good story to tell. So Erica did a really good job working with the reporter, and we actually have the Herald following up on this, so there'll be a story out this weekend on this topic.
With the battery, the Arlington side.
The Ameresco project.
Oh, okay, this one's going to be Ameresco.
Yes, yeah. So yeah, story in the Herald coming up. Like I said, good story to tell, you know, working closely with the city. Obviously, with the Crosswind Transmission Project also going on up there, there's just a lot of conflation with Project Cascade, data centers, all that. We're trying to clarify that with the board, make it very clear that Crosswind is serving our battery energy storage and things like that. And we've also had a lot of information in, like, the City of Arlington newsletter, making sure that the residents are, you know, knowledgeable of this.
May I? Why do you think that could be controversial?
Battery energy storage has, a lot of the projects have become controversial in some of the cities where they're putting, trying to put projects. So Skagit Valley, some of those areas have, you know, opponents to some of these projects coming out. So
they have, like, any inputs why? I mean, they don't like these projects and place or something against that.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with, like, farmland, taking up land. A lot of it is very similar to the data center conversations going on.
Okay, thank you.
There's a fear of fire.
Yeah, that's the other concern.
Safety concerns, which we have a good story to tell as well. We work really closely with the City of Arlington's Fire Department on this project and our microgrid project as well. And data centers, obviously, still very much in the headlines. We were mentioned in an op-ed that ran the Herald, kind of really pushing to have the county put forward a moratorium. Obviously, we've seen a lot of headlines across the state, across our area, with Snohomish County, Skagit County, Seattle, putting in these moratoriums. So just kind of wanted to mention that we're paying close attention to this. In August, in The Wire, we're going to put out some information talking about this, kind of clarifying our role with data centers, and how we kind of field these requests from large loads and how we deal with them.
This is a media report, but when I looked at this, it's local control, state or federal mandate to have a moratorium on any data center in the country. Would supersede something that we're doing. Let's say the federal government said, we want more of these, and you're going to do it. Does something like that supersede the authority of the local municipality?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if Colin can.
Yeah, short answer. So local zoning and permitting regulations are vested within the local jurisdiction. So it is, to your question, it is a local control question.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Can I add something to your comment? Because I intrigued about a moratorium to the, yes, approved for the county council. So before serving as a city council, I know that every city, they have their own rules, regulations, and everything. So how are the county council going to implement and put in, yeah, in place that moratorium for all the cities when every city has their own rules to do the zone permits, the rezone of every single project? So the county can can overview, but can suggest, but they cannot stop the cities, right? If the city said, okay, we received this project and we are okay with the zoning, we're okay with all the permits in place. So I guess curious.
Yeah, the moratorium the county did is only for the unincorporated part of the
Yes, I saw that too.
Yeah, so the cities are on their own.
Yeah, that is the point, because I mean, they cannot. So only for clarification for the people that they've seen this news, right? It's like, okay, it's a moratorium, but there's only for unincorporated areas they can control, but not the cities. Okay, thank you.
And I think we've been doing this, but it's a good opportunity to help the public understand the depth and breadth of data centers.
Yeah.
That's the data centers are already everywhere, smaller ones, what they do for us.
Yeah, and that's part of the information we're going to put out in August.
Dreaming the World Cup.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, also, we're seeing a lot of these things.
Yeah, and clarifying our role in it, right? Yeah. How we take these requests and how we, you know, they serve them, they build it. Seattle Times have been working on this story for quite a while. Affordability and electricity, obviously a hot topic right now going on. This story really focused on PSC and CLC alike and a lot of challenges we're all facing. That said, I loved this graphic very much. I woke up that Monday morning and was very ecstatic about it. So Erica worked with the reporter to get her some of our information. Rates was very helpful. Peter and Christina getting a lot of historical rate information of them. And I think it's a great visual to show how we've done a good job of keeping our rates fairly flat, well, our peers have not. Hydropower, Garrison Marr, had an interview with Everett Post talking about kind of where we're at with the court injunction and BPA. That came off really well. Garrison was really stressed the confidence we have that things will work out moving forward despite the court injunction. Couple little briefs. We had a summer project press release, which we always put out, just highlighting all the work that we're doing this summer, really focusing also on vegetation management and all that we do to kind of prepare for storm season, but also really focusing on wildfire as well as we go into summer. Cairo did a story on canine catching a suspect. They actually broke into one of our storage buildings out of Jackson, and our security cameras caught them and helped catch the perpetrator. And then Sound Transit. Commissioner Logan, you actually spoke at the Sound Transit meeting recently, and let us pick that up and just talking about our support for that.
I got impressed at the Tim White.
Good way.
Something I didn't have in my bucket.
The Wire wanted to highlight the Wire for July, really focusing on simple, kind of easy tips people can take for summer energy conservation. We also highlighted the amazing job our water AMI deployment team has done finishing up that ahead of schedule and under budget. And then just some safety tips around drones and highlighting the summary report that comes out each year. And then finally, I wanted to highlight some, I don't always talk about internal, but really wanted to highlight the magazine that we've been putting out and kind of working to get it into really a better shape and kind of trying to serve these outside crews. And so Kelsey Wiebe and David have done an amazing job to put this together each month. And we're thankful for, you know, the crews that they let us come out and talk to them, take photos. I think it's really, really served as a great tool for, you know, reaching some of those supported audiences that don't maybe read District Daily every day. Stuff on the blog.
We have a safety issue with this. The guy's sitting on the cross arm.
Well, they're artists.
Yeah, they're tight.
They are tight.
When I saw this picture, it reminded me of old pictures of building skyscrapers.
Yes.
Right from the turn of the century.
Yeah.
People sitting with their lunch boxes out on a girder. Like,
yeah,
they were not tight.
They were not tight.
Yeah.
And you could not see the ground in the back the backdrop, but
they were much.
A great picture.
Yeah, we love this one.
Turned out to be an amazing picture.
I believe Chris does put it in for a while.
That's
all for me.
Any questions?
No.
No.
I think you should talk to the parents about signing those babies. It's pretty photogenic for your team to you. Oh, very much.
Hard. Yeah, that was fun.
There's some good social media potential.
Definitely.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Daniel, we're still.
There you go, annual report.
Excellent. Thank you, Aaron. Also, in our updates, we wanted to include the TransAlta cost recovery filing. And Garrison Morris has to give us an update.
Good morning, John. Good morning, commissioners. So this is just an informational briefing. Wanted to make sure that commissioners were aware of some of the details of the TransAlta request to FERC and how that may impact the PUD so that the commission is up to speed on where that sits and what might happen next. So DOE, Department of Energy, did issue a 90-day emergency order to keep the Centralia plant, coal plant in Centralia, Washington, to keep that running and avoid its closure in December 2025. That emergency order has been followed up twice with two renewals of the emergency order. And the last of those extends it into September of 2026. So that's what's been going on. TransAlta is the owner of that coal plant. And recently, TransAlta made a reimbursement request for FERC approval. FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for about $20 million for the period covering just that first 90-day emergency order. That request they proposed to split between BPA, Bonneville Power Administration, and CalISO. Their rationale was that BPA is the balancing authority for the plant, CalISO is the reliability coordinator for the plant. We'll revisit those points shortly. And the PUD has been involved along with Northwest Requirements Utilities and Public Power Council. BPA also has joined into that and essentially saying these charges aren't appropriate for BPA. And here is where we will revisit the balancing authority and the reliability coordinator claims. So the content of the comments that we and our peers have made are that the basis of this cost recovery request is inappropriate, A, because no power was generated from that plant, so the basis of the cost to recover is a little squishy. Cost causation principles would be violated because of the arguments of who should pay and why. And here is where we'll get into that balancing authority. So BPA is not the balancing authority for the Centralia plant. And CalISO is not the reliability coordinator. So the Department of Energy made an error in that emergency order. And TransAlta repeated that error in their revenue recovery request. So GridForce is the balancing authority. And Southwest Power Pool is the reliability coordinator. TransAlta actually updates their revenue recovery request for the second and the third 90-day emergency orders. So in some ways, that's an acknowledgement that that first one may not have been correct. In addition, the revenue recovery request came 135 days after the emergency order and well after the 90-day period for that emergency order. So there's additional arguments that revenue recovery request appropriately should have been done before the period started, justifying what it would be and how it would be counted and who would pay it. But it coming after those periods violates FERC's prohibition, sort of after the fact, rate making mechanisms. So sort of where we are. You know, this still has to go to FERC to be held for a hearing on this. Our comments are in. TransAlta has an opportunity to respond to those hearings. Then FERC will assemble the panel to hear it. So the timeline right now is not known. It could extend for a while. We may, because we're BPA's biggest customer, have some exposure if FERC finds that the request was appropriate, but a really good defense has been put in place here because of Joe Fina, who's our FERC attorney and is incredible. And we also know that BPA is not named in the revenue recovery request for the second and the third emergency order. So pretty limited exposure there. And, you know, we feel like we're in a good spot in terms of making the case on this one. So that's what I have for you today. Just wanted to make sure that we are up to speed on what it was, why it may not work out for TransAlta, what our exposure looks like, and what the timing is. Are there any questions?
I just have a comment. I think TransAlta attorneys would know what they're balancing authority was. I'm sorry. I'm assuming the attorneys were stopping, smiling. Anyway, just an opportunity.
I echo that comment from speaking.
I've got a couple of questions. First, does FERC have the authority to tell a private company they have to keep a plant going or start a plant back up?
I might look to Colin for FERC's rights on this one.
Yeah, I would look to Joe as our it's the Department of Energy that has the authority.
Okay. And then what does the $20 million represent? What work was done? What's the expense?
It's hard to track in the first revenue recovery request. In the second and third, they talk about repairs that incurred costs to make it available for being a generating resource for the reason, but it's a little tenuous what those costs actually reflect in the first emergency order.
And then aside, I was at the EPA, had two strangers go up to me saying how much they like working with Joe. I think next time I would have it been alive with Joe. it's a huge credit to Joe. Joe is nationally recognized for his expertise. I know.
Absolutely. Joe's on vacation now, which is why I'm here, but Joe is somebody that checks the recordings on these, so let the record show that Commissioner Logan, myself, Colin all said Joe's just incredible.
Yeah. And then Tony said they can't have him. Boy, thank you.
Thank you, Garrison. Appreciate that. All right. Up to our Bell 3-year lease extension and Marine Barnes. And actually, Maureen is going to have the first two on the agenda. Morning, Maureen.
Good morning. Morning, commissioners. So we're talking about a 3-year lease extension. I'm Maureen Barnes, manager of real estate services. So lease extension for yard space. The purpose of the presentation is informational. I wanted to let everybody know that a 3-year lease extension with Linda Bell of Roger Bell Real Estate Holdings, located at 1450 80th Street, Southwest Everett, which is the Morgan Aero building. So it's just the second building out of the east, gated ops. Outline the primary terms of the extension. The original lease was approved by resolution number 6149 on October 7th, 2023. The lease extension will be brought back to commission for approval by resolution at July 21st commission meeting. So in October of 2023, a 3-year lease for approximately 1 acre of land was leased for additional storage at OP. This yard is still needed for an additional 3-year term. Although we have long-term plans to increase our current storage capacity, it has taken longer than expected for the planning and for the permitting. Facilities has budgeted for these upgrades, and the additional 3 years will allow the plan to come to fruition. The 1+ acre, as I said, is only a few hundred feet from the east gate at OPS. After the 3 years, we have actually looked at other sites that we have if additional storage is continued to be needed, to go ahead and do something with those. We thought for sure that the 3 years would cover it, but we still have some supply chain shortage. So we're having to order quite a bit and a number of capital projects. And although our campus is large, additional space is needed. And I apologize, I actually didn't get very good pictures of showing the spaces. Looks kind of empty. But I think everybody knows that we're pretty much at capacity. The lease extension terms and the next steps. The extension would be for three years. At the time that we did the initial lease, an option was not offered to us. We thought it would just be short term. Luckily, they did go ahead and agree to 3 years. Unfortunately, the lease rate was about 15 cents back in 2023 per square foot. So it started out about 6,000 per month. They have increased it up to 30 cents per square foot, and they wanted the lease rate to start at approximately $10,500. We said that was pretty much not acceptable, too large of a leap. We did kind of work something out with an incremental increase, which year one would be 18 cents per square foot, year two, 21, year three, 24 cents per square foot, and that would bring us up to what they're saying is market rate for open space. We'll see. Staff will return on July 21st for commissioners to vote via resolution. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I do have a question. Don't we have, was a church, a facility near Ops for the meters?
Yeah, the 75th Street building.
So I don't know what the square footage of that is, but is that an opportunity to move some things there?
Not really. And Marie, yeah,
we looked at that extensively, and though it is a little over 8 acres there, with all of the storage we currently have, and also the topography, it just wouldn't work. We tried. I did find a lot that we own that's less than 5 miles away that we thought, well, this one could be great. It's not as convenient. But that was going to cost close to $500,000 to bring it with the permitting up to code to be able to allow us to use it as a storage facility. We'll have that still in our back pocket, knowing that we can do that in the future, but we feel real strongly that the 3 years will buy us that time to get our storage straightened out at Ops and also at the 75th Street building.
At Ops, would that consider... I have my foggy memory on when that was constructed. There was a lot of fog there where we couldn't build. At that point, it was considered marshland or something.
I think it was considered for drainage, and that's what they're working through right now on the permitting.
Oh, yeah. And they need to be able to use that.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
So only for clarification, the extension will be only for 3 years.
Correct.
And this is exactly how it's desegregated, the year one, year two, year three, per month. It is going to be the price.
Exactly.
No, all in place.
Right, just that.
Thank you.
And let me just add a little bit of context. So this 3 years buys us time to coordinate with our overall facilities plan, and specifically the ops plan and the layout and how we want that to look going forward, especially from a storage and lay down and the whole effective supply chain and material process. So this really just buys us some additional time to continue to work through all the available options and to land in a place that would be the long-term strategy.
That might consider reconfiguring some of that.
Yes.
Rebuilding.
Yep. Yeah. Because we have lots of other things going on at Ops that we need to kind of tend to.
Yeah.
And this is just one of the pieces for the longer term.
Be careful taking down that main building there, because it may fall down.
Well, that's one of the things that we are doing. Thanks for the tip.
Well, it seems like considering the challenge of the supply chain is still linger.
Yep. All right, thanks, Maureen. I think
think we're good to move on to the next one, the home warehouse space.
We're all about space today. I'm still Maureen Barnes, manager of the space. I don't know if I have to say anything. I had a hat, I'd change it. So lease of warehouse space. The purpose of the presentation is informational and just to inform the board of the proposed three-year lease with 33809 Highway 2 LLC located at 314139th Avenue Southeast in Sultan. Outline the primary terms of the lease. The lease will be brought to commission for approval by resolution at the July 21st meeting. So, warehouse lease, a little bit of background. Originally, Generation consisted of only one site, which was Jackson, in 1984 up to about 2008. We've grown, and now we have five hydroelectric sites and one biogas site, which are all supported from the Jackson site in Sultan. Jackson has gone from being an unmanned powerhouse to having 18 to 20 people regularly reporting and working from the campus. This includes housing natural resource equipment, recreation site equipment, in addition to needed operations equipment. Also, there is equipment that is stored currently at Ops. The Jackson campus is constrained and additional storage is needed while we make plans to grow our campus up there also. Space is tight. In pictures that kind of show it. One of the things that kind of jumped out to me is that Scott had let me know is that there's a lot of equipment that is stored outside uncovered, and it really should be undercover. So although we have long-term plans to increase our current storage capacity, this will take time and planning. And we have been looking for quite some time and working out potential purchases of property right there. So during this time of planning, a short-term solution is needed. We've located a closed warehouse space for a lease in Fulton, which has an available 11,520 square foot warehouse for lease at 75 cents per square foot. The site is located at 339th Avenue Southeast and State Route 2. Basically, it's 5 miles, only 10 minutes from the Jackson campus. There also is additional outside storage space. If we feel like we need a little bit more room, they are willing to work with us on additional space if needed. So this just shows the warehouse and where it is. So the lease term would be 3 years with an option to extend for an additional three-year term. Monthly rent would start out at $6,500. Which would have a yearly 3% escalation, which is standard in the industry at this time. Additional fees include not a triple net. This is only the pro rata portion of property taxes, which are approximately $180 per month. Staff will return on July 21st for approval to enter into the lease via resolution. And again, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm just curious, I mean, how much it costs if we want to buy the property? Because it's the 3 years plus another 3 years potentially additional, right? So
right.
I don't know, to
purchase that specific property or other, we have talked to them about that. Right now, the lease that'll come through that you'll see will show us as a sublessor, because right now it's currently leased to another person who has let us know that there's a possibility they would be willing to sell in just a few years. Okay. So that's something we've already been looking at, plus sites that are closer to our Jackson site.
And that 3%, the escalation additional fee is going to increase by year?
By year, pretty much 1.5 to 3% is pretty standard per year. They had originally written up the lease at 5%. We said, no. We actually do know what we're doing, and 3% is pretty much top. So we got them down on that one.
Thank you.
So what do we do to security of this thing? I mean, we had excellent canine safe day for us there. What are we doing anything particular? Are we going to be mean assets in there that copper or something that would be high targets or?
I'm not going to attempt to answer that because I wouldn't know, but I do have Scott here.
Yeah, no.
Scott, you make your name.
Our manager of generation engineering. Security is definitely part of the conversation here. We've seen, news about the break-ins up there. Those reels of copper are currently being kept, kind of in a fence yard or conic buildings that are not well protected at Jackson. This is all fenced, and it's a lockable warehouse. We plan to do a security improvements. So we'd probably put up a web-based camera. It's Starlink. We've inquired about any, security problems at this location. We haven't heard any. I think it's certainly going to be take a step up from what we have, Jackson, correct?
My next question is this kind of storage potentially part of when we find an east side site for the next office? That would be the Monroe event. Are these close enough? I'm just concerned about having buildings somewhere that aren't really around employees that can keep an eye on things. I'm just wondering how does that work?
We all agree with you on that. And looking at the east side, looking for the site for that, we are looking at larger sites so that we can have additional storage. So we wouldn't need to go outside and lease.
I just didn't know that would still be too far away from Jackson.
I think Scott's better to answer the logistics question.
Yeah, we've been, to your point, we've been coordinating with facilities on this issue. We inquired with them specifically about the East County search. Their search area would be considerably further from Jackson than this location. And, essentially, it would go from being 10 minutes from our campus to 25, 30 minutes, which would be logistically difficult. I would say, to previous comment, that we work with facilities that are aware of this location. I think they're intrigued, but they're going through a comprehensive determining in there for.
Another question?
Picking up on what Commissioner Altman Crosby said with regard to ongoing rentals. I say caution, do all of your due diligence. And it's a very complex site, I understand that. But the longer we go, the rental costs do pile up. So I hope we're not moving 5-6 years into the future.
I agree. Again, we want to make sure, though, when we do come up with a permanent site, it fits with the overall facilities plan and works for, in this case, for generation, from the logistics, where the equipment is located, how accessible is it to the different work area that generation folks have to cover.
Well, that work
at all will
take a long time.
We're moving on it. That's all part of one of our key strategic priorities now is the overall facilities plan, and each one of these pieces fit into that. All of that is part of it, absolutely.
I get a little queasy parking around a big transformer.
They have all those orange cones out.
Yeah. And that's why we put those big concrete pillars up there, so you don't run it.
Thank you.
I'd like to add something. I'm not against anything like that. We need a space. We need a space. It's there, but I try to think about it. What is better than how we can spend our money? right? Because if we multiply 6,500 times for 3 years and then for six as a value of the property, there is the amount. So it's better maybe if we can buy a property, it's better to own the property rather than rent the property because we are growing and we are continuing growing. So, and I know the safety is a crucial, is number one, but we have to make sure how we can spend our money wisely. That's all. Thank you.
Excellent. Good points.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Marie. Thank you, Scott. Next up is the Peak Assist Demand Response Program and Shane Fry. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, John. Okay. All right. My name is Shane Fry. I'm program manager in our strategic accounts department. And with me is Nick Peretti. He is the professional engineer for our energy storage and emerging technologies team. And together we're creating the Peak Assist program that we're excited to present to you today. The purpose is informational, but feel free to jump in with any questions at any time. So the creation of this program is to fall under our rate portfolio guiding principles umbrella. We want to support the grid, helping keep our costs low and supporting compliance. For our customers, make sure that it's an equitable experience for them and make sure that there's no risk to the customer with this program. And it's also for the business to make sure the systems are right size and staffing, basically to help prepare us for the future. What is Peak Assist? Our Peak Assist program is a voluntary behavioral response program that asks our customers to change their behavior during a peak event, a 2 to 3 hour event where we would ask them to conserve energy during that period of time. The good thing about the program is, or one of the good things about the program is that there is no risk and no smart devices required. All residential customers are invited, which means our AMI customers, our non-AMI customers, all customers are invited. Our intention is to offer incentives to those customers to sign up for the program. So they would get an initial sign-up bill credit, and then we would also offer them initial bill opportunities to win bill credits through drawings as they engage with us throughout the year. The intention of this, the program, is to introduce customers to the value of shifting energy, show them what demand response programs are, but it also gives us the opportunity to learn from our customers' behavior during these events. And it advances reliable and cost-effective energy goals. Why create Peak Assist? I'm going to let Nick speak to that.
Nick Peretti, Energy Storage and Emerging Technologies. Big fan of graphs with squiggles that mean something. So that's what we got here. So what our goal is to identify a peak. You can see on the right-hand side here, there's a Peak Assist event coming. This is kind of looking at the 2 days leading up to that Peak Assist event. And so we are forecasting our load constantly. That's an important thing for the PUD to do to make sure that we're meeting goals. And then day before the event, we'll actually call the event and send a notification out to our customers so they can know what time period that we want to conserve energy for. And then the next day that event would occur and we'd have the opportunity to survey those customers and get their responses. Again, just kind of repeating why we're doing this. It supports our energy goals, right? We want to reduce our peak energy during our peak periods of the month. We want that equitable program that everyone can participate in. There isn't any boundary to joining. And then it prepares us for the future. Programs like this, opportunities for the customer to participate with us, creating different programs for customers to engage with, is part of the portfolio that needs to be developed for good use of our energy and finding ways to reduce our costs.
So let me understand. You don't have to have a smart meter to do it. But it sounds like we will, for those customers that are enrolled, look at their data,
correct,
to see if we did get the result we're looking for, or right, what result we got.
Yes. Back to Dane.
Thanks, Nick. All right, how will we do it? So another great thing about this program is that we can utilize existing business tools. We do not need to go outside for contracts outside the utility. We're utilizing everything that we have here at the PUD currently. Our current program SAP, we're using my Snow PUD, multiple programs that we have internally and working with the departments that are in like Nick's department, you know, using his DERM software to predict the events and call the events. We're going to have targeted customer communication. So we will outreach to as many customers as we possibly can through as many avenues as we possibly can, which means our corporate communications team, utilizing and working with our income qualified program manager, Missy, as well as our engagement council, and any other avenue that we have to outreach to these customers to give them the opportunity to sign up for this program. And what we will be doing is asking the customer to sign up for the program while offering them the $25 sign up bill credit. They will receive that credit once they sign up for the program and fill out the first survey after the first event. That way we keep them engaged and know that they are going to continue to stay engaged throughout the program. After each event, we send these customers a survey and ask them if they participated, if they did not participate, and ask them why either way. This way, for the customers that do not have AMI meters, we can also gain information from them, understanding how they participated or did not participate and why, and what they did if they did participate. And then that way we can gather that data and use that to build out the program or future programs. Again, ongoing customer engagement. So throughout this program, we'll be working with corporate communications to do outreach to the customers, maybe even engage in other activities, making sure that we're going out to events to make sure that we communicate and engage with our customers, not just via the website or but we're also out in the county engaging with our customers for this program. Next software will then forecast and call the event. And then once we schedule that event, we will notify the customer a day ahead. They'll get a reminder 2 hours ahead of the program. They'll be notified when the program is happening or when the event starts. And then when the event ends, after the event ends, we'll send them that survey as a link for them to fill out. Our intent is to make it as simple and easy as possible. Again, the post-event behavior survey, that's for the customer to fill out. And when they do submit those surveys, they get entries into monthly and annual drawings for bill credits. So that's another way of helping us keep them engaged. And then we want to celebrate and promote the successes. So we want to actually try to put out newsletters either after each event or during every 3 months in the middle of the year to let customers know how we're doing, how things are going with the program, and make sure that everybody knows that this program is successful. And as you can see here, this is an example of a flyer on the left hand side there that we would send out to the customer. We would offer it in additional languages. Then in the middle there, what you see there is how they would sign up for the program via My Snow PUD. And then the example on the right-hand side there is an event alert that goes out. This is a text message. It would also be offered via email.
So in this example, there's 8 monthly and 25 year-end meters. How do we determine how many? We don't know how many will sign up. If you anticipate a certain number, I'm trying to think of the reward, right? I mean, if we had 100,000 sign up, how many would be versus the lottery?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, for the first month, I think odds are probably going to be good for customers to have an opportunity to win a bill credit. But we will, as the program goes on, we will actually look at this to see if it needs to change, whether we want to expand that to make addition or to give additional bill credits and just ramp it up if we need to. Our initial year goal is around 4,500 to 7,000 customers for the first year.
So this is not a pilot. This is an annual program.
This is a program.
And can you talk about the drawing to give the benefit as opposed to just giving everyone an automatic small benefit? Just curious how the team came to that decision.
We felt that this was a way for customers to be engaged on a monthly basis or on an event basis, because this way, once we send out that survey, it tells us, we know that they're engaged because they're sending us that survey. So that way, when they send us that survey, we say, thank you, here's an entry into a drawing. Instead of giving that small bill credit, this is an opportunity for them to win a larger bill credit.
I think you, earlier on, I think this was the question you asked that went right over my head. There's a monitoring of whether they comply. So they don't get a credit if they don't comply. I mean, you take them off the program.
So there's no risk to being on the program. So if they sign up for the program, they can stay on it. They just wouldn't get the bill credit until they fill out that first survey to get that initial $25 bill credit.
Okay.
Take that a little further. If we were just to give them that $25 bill credit right when they sign up,
right,
then yeah, they
can. I understand that, but the next month, and the next month, and the next month.
So
they say, I got the $25 left. No, I'm not going to be attention to them.
Which is that is their option if they want to participate or not. Although we will let them know that if they do fill out those surveys, they will get additional entries for the monthly drawings and the annual drawings. So it's to help keep them engaged. And the drawings are, like, as you see, $50 for a bill credit and $200 for a bill credit. That's that, hoping that that's enough incentive for them to continue to be engaged.
Remember, Commissioner Warren, when we did those three pilots, one of them was just a voluntary program.
Right.
And people actually complied. Was really, I think, no benefit. Was there no benefit? A little benefit. Yeah. But it seemed like that was the most successful.
Yes. Good morning, John Hoffman, your Chief Customer Officer. I wanted to follow up on one thing because you're hitting on exactly what I don't know that we've highlighted here. If you think back to Susie's presentation and the prior commission meeting about ensuring that we have a rate strategy for every customer. One thing that we're working hard to wrap our minds around is this idea that we aren't going to create a program or rate that every customer is going to benefit from, but we need to have programs and rates for every customer. One of the challenges we have is that some of the programs in the past where we've said, oh, if you do this behavior, you'll get a dollar or two, there are customers who that's not going to motivate their behavior. This program, we are leaning heavy into the community support aspect, because that same customer that may not respond for a dollar or two will respond if they know that they're helping their neighborhood and their community out. And so that's where our focus on this is really on that support your community. And while we are doing the drawings, we don't believe that it's actually financial benefit that's going to get the majority of customers to participate in this program. We think it's the giving back for your community. And we will have other programs that will come that could potentially be more financially lucrative for those that are triggered on dollar route.
Yeah, and I guess as our program gets rolled out, we will get feedback and always change the program. That will do it to make it work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Lucrative.
You
also, when you're monitoring, you're going to see how effective it is in shaping the community.
Correct. Yeah.
Is there a saturation point where, I mean, how many do you need in order realistically on average?
Yeah, so our peaks have shape to them, right? Some are steeper and some are flatter. And so, yes, there is
theoretically a certain amount of customers that we need, but we have plenty of room for customers. And so that's part of that. As we get engagement and we get that meter reading from the customers that do have AMI, we can adjust the incentives to increase enrollment or flatten out to make sure that we're getting the most out of the program for our customers.
And then also remember that these types of programs are tied to our IRP and the things that we need to do. We're starting to establish going forward, paint that, you know, shave that paint. Yeah.
I have a question. Yes. May I follow comments?
Questions.
So I'm just curious how many people we consider that they're going to win $50, $200. I don't know how many people that you think that we're going to have. They're going to sign for this. Or are we prepared for how many people that we can give
50 and 200? So, yeah, our initial year goal is around 4,500 customers, even up to 7,000. And so for the first year, we're willing to offer 8 bill credits per month, and then it's 10 $200 annual bill credits. I believe. And so, yeah. And then once that year is up, then we will go reevaluate and decide whether we need to change that to maybe more, because maybe we get 20, 30,000 customers. And so, you know, as we get more customers, that amount is less significant because the, you know, your odds are a little less. But again, like John stated, I mean, the biggest thing is putting this out to the community, because we know the community wants to help us, help each other. And that's the big reason why we're putting this together.
And talking about community, I look at the flyer, it's amazing. But for example, if we want to be intentional, if you're going to translate the PIC assist program in Spanish, is asistencia de pico. It's like, what the heck is this? It doesn't say anything exactly with a flyer. I mean, if it's in Spanish, it's nothing. It's like, what is this? Mm-hmm. So asistencia de picos, maybe asistencia con tu recibo de energía. So you have to translate, but intentional. I don't know the other languages because I don't speak other, but maybe you need to look at it that you cannot translate like that in order to keep the attention, because we want as many people, mostly thinking about other communities too, and the equity piece, right? So another suggestion, and notifications via email or text. Many, many, many people, they are customers, they don't have emails. So they use the text or they use WhatsApp. I know different organizations, they create the WhatsApp an app, and they start to send through WhatsApp to different people, and that's intentional too. Another thing is maybe you can send emails to the schools and the libraries, and they already have the network with different organizations, and maybe perhaps they can send the emails. And also another thing, maybe they're going to have the event on Tuesday, right? And you're going to have the organizations there. So maybe to send the emails and phone calls to communicate that we have this amazing opportunity. Also, if you have somebody that speaks other languages, maybe a little video and intentional, hey, te invitamos a que participes en este survey. Te puedes ganar 25, 50, 200. I don't know. You have to figure out something like that. Because look at the flyer, yes, in English is really intentional, but like another bill credit is crédito en la factura. So you get a credit, you get a bonus, but in what? Factura is, I don't know, it's another receipt. So that's it. But no, it's amazing. I think that if we do very intentional, I mean, versus good intentions, we're going to have many customers. They're going to engage, and also those customers that really need that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's absolutely it. We want to be able to engage with our attention. All right, next steps. So we continue to build out the system. So we're a good portion of the way through it. currently, but we still have some work to do and test it out. Working with CorpCom to finalize the language and marketing kind of speaks to what you were saying. Develop and conduct training for customer service. So making sure that our customer service team is well prepared when they get the call in about this program, as well as maybe doing videos for our customers to show them how to sign up for the program. Great reporting. This is making sure that we are reporting on all of our customer signups, that we're keeping track. We're keeping track of surveys and performance data. And then our intention is to launch fourth quarter of this year.
Question for Colin. Colin, is this an actual rate that the board has to approve?
No, it's a program. And I think I was waiting for the question of gifting, but it relates to using dollars to incentivize engagement, knowing that we're not directly tracking customer activity. But it is appropriate. You've seen that with the state on around advertising and promoting their services and products. So the survey component is that critical link where we're getting feedback from customers and incentivizing their participation.
I just want to add next steps before the board approves this level.
Awesome.
Thank
you.
Thank you
very much.
Excellent. Thank you, Shane.
So it's 10:11. Let's take a 9-minute break, or John, short minute break. Come back at 10:12. Come back in 10:05. It is 10:20, and we are back.
Hold a moment for our general manager to
kick off the next book. Want to get there?
Harold,
you're okay. You asked if anyone was a good singer. Fill the time. Well, there you go.
Very good deal.
Yeah.
I can do this fine.
All right, John. Here is our next speaker.
Yes, sir. Ledger. Next up is the Flex Ready for Business Pilot Rate Program. Chris Gutter. And Doug O'Donnell. Morning, Chris. Morning, Doug.
Morning, commissioners. I'm Chris Gutter. I'm a utility analyst in Power Supply Group. With me, I have Doug O'Donnell, senior account manager in key accounts. We're here to talk about the Flex Ready for Business pilot rate that we want to launch in a couple commission meetings. So today, I kind of want to go over the program design, talk about why it's a win-win for us and our customers, give you some timeline. Today is informational, but it's designed to support a commission resolution on August 4th to launch the pilot rate. Big takeaways from today I want you all to go away with is we're supporting our rate strategy program, and we're really trying to design these programs in an innovative way to work with our customers to ensure that we're bringing to our customers programs that they really can take advantage of. With that, let's talk about the program design. The genesis of this program really is in Washington State Bill 5445, which gave regulatory compliance benefits to demand response programs. Within that framework, we wanted to take advantage of programs that didn't require a large overhead, didn't have a huge, a big IT need, had low risk and low complexity. And this program is designed for large business and industrial customers. Those are on Schedule 20 or Schedule 36, where they could partner with us to elect an amount of load that they would be able to shift or shed during a called event. This program is designed to be low technology. You don't need AMI meters. You don't need any sort of back-end systems, and it adds a new resiliency tool here for us at the district, while giving us some regulatory benefits on the backside. The way this is going to work is business customers will elect an amount of load based on their peak load demands over the previous year that can be interrupted or flexible. We will make at most one call per year and at most 1 hour per event. That is at most, these are not planned to be, these are on a planning basis, 1 in 10 year events. So we're talking extreme grid stress events. And we use these as a resiliency tool in those cases where we're experiencing grid stress. We then use the program attributes in our Energy Independence Act filings in April, and we value back to the customer the what we get out of it in terms of those regulatory benefits.
Quick question,
sir.
One event per year, 1 hour per event. Would everybody be called out the same hour, or would we stagger them to sort of shave like a 2 or 3 hour peak or something?
So that would probably depend a bit on what the program looks like. As I said, this program is not designed to be continually called. So if the regional grid is facing a stress amount and we know it's over a longer period of time, we might stagger it out. But we would not be using this as a tool for everyday sort of high load events. So we think this is a win-win for all. Win-win for the PUD and for our customers. It's a low-cost tool that has low overhead, low complexity, and low risk for both us and the customer. Customer participation is optional. So if they do not participate, let's say they've elected an amount of 100 kilowatts, and they do not participate, they forego credit the following year, but we are not penalizing the customer. We're not doing clawbacks, and we would just reevaluate them in the following year. For example, that 100 kilowatts of attested load is worth about $2,500 annually to our business customers. It's really simple. If an event is called, we will use actual measurements. Otherwise, we would go off of what the customer tells us that they could do. So one of the keys of this program is keeping those administrative costs low, keeping complexity low, keeping resiliency high, and working within an IT framework where we don't have to develop a lot of customer systems. With that, I'm going to pass it over to Doug, who's going to talk about our near-term timeline, and then I'll come back and talk next steps.
Thank you, Chris. Doug O'Donnell, account manager representing PUD Key Accounts. The Key Accounts has been working with our partners in Rate and Power Supply for several years on this type of program. And really the dynamic is with something like this is we represent the voice of the customer. So we're either interpreting customer needs, customer desires, or we're actually, in this case, setting up meetings to discuss this program and its design with our colleagues in Power Supply and Rates. So our customer engagement is underway now. We've spoken with several customers. We're looking at a segment from heavy industrial to water, wastewater, water, wastewater, industrial, and cold storage. So kind of the common factor that these customers have, and this is something we've learned for the years, is that they have some sort of storage. So we think that storage is battery, but if you think of a water district, they'll have a reservoir, a water tower that they can set aside use for an hour and participate in this program. Industrial, we've got a large foundry that can actually hold molten iron for up to 4 hours, so they can participate in this program. Cold storage, simple as, hey, let's not open the freezer doors for an hour while this call is underway. So those are the type of customers that we've learned to reach out to over the years. And as I said, iterative approach, we've rolled out and presented several programs over the years to customers, including one with BPA that was a full-on demand response call program, and learned a lot through that. Learned a lot through other iterations of this program. As Chris was saying, win-win. As voice of the customer, we're really hard on these guys because we pretty much know what customers are going to say is what's in it for us. How do you keep our risk to a minimum? And how much money can we earn through this and benefit our business? So the businesses need to make a cost-benefit analysis. We're asking them basically to take either a full or partial power outage for an hour. And Commissioner Logan, big school, you can imagine if we were to call school district to say, hey, can you shut down operations? In the middle of the day, it's not going to work. So specific customers and a specific benefit. So from a key account perspective, we think the team has done a great job. This is the best customer-facing, customer-benefiting program that we've seen in this vein. So moving forward, we're going to sign up customers later this fall, similar to the earlier program. And then the customers would expect to see payments, their first payments in January 2027. And then the payments will come in form of a bill credit. And these credits will go run year to year, providing recurring value to the customer and to the district. And then the pilot is set to run through 2030, and then we'll evaluate it. Our team will evaluate it. We'll evaluate it with our participating customers to see how it's gone and how we can improve it and make it better. Keep going. All right, back to you. Questions for Doug?
So this replaces anything that we perhaps do now, but we don't do it now.
We don't have a formal program. We do have a low curtailment program.
Yeah.
But that's very limited in customer versus patient. We really protect our customers. So it's limited.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question. How are you planning to evaluate this program here to you?
I'll let Chris follow up on this, but we will have deep conversations with our participating customers. We did that with the BPA program and learned a lot that we're applying here. And so that will happen with customer interviews. A lot of these customers, well, key accounts, we have deep relationships with all the customers we've spoken with. So they're very open with us. They don't pull their punches. And so that will happen. Chris, I'll turn it over to you.
Here we go. Several years ago, we worked out a program. It's pretty exciting. I don't know if it's still there or not. So the city of Everett Wastewater.
Yes.
We were helping. It was a win-win on time of day when they pump, what the level of the tide was. Do we still have a program with them?
That has retired.
Okay.
Yeah, that retired about, I'll say a year ago. Don't call me on that. That program has been retired. It was a great program, though. And also learnings came from that. And it's really, customers need to know, is it worth it for us? Having calls might mean at 3 a.m. sending staff to a currently on staff site. So, but yeah, we're still going here. Chris?
Thank you, Doug. Commissioner Altmaier, I'm happy to follow up on your question. In 2030, there are some interesting interactions between state environmental policies. We have planned that out in our IRP. Between 2030 and 2035, we'll start to see some of those changes. So we're going to evaluate participation, value, and need in those years. We're also hoping that this is purely a launching pad, and this is not the last program we develop, but rather a start and a beginning where we can continue to develop more programs for our commercial industrial customers that take advantage of different aspects as we go further into the late 2020s.
Thank you.
So next steps for us. As I mentioned, this is a pilot rate, so you will be asked to vote on this as a resolution on August 4th. We're planning to hold a formal public hearing on July 21st. We'll be back in 2 weeks, and then we'll be back 2 weeks after that. I'm also happy to take any questions that anybody has.
Have you already reached out to some?
Yeah.
Therefore, there's been an exchange of what's being planned and got their input.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So, you're doing more outreach or?
So our initial outreach was through key accounts to some of our sectors that we thought could take advantage of this really well to get feedback and make sure that our program was aligned with their needs and we would have the excitement they would want to join. Early findings has been largely positive. We've had a lot of customers say, yes, this is something we would at least evaluate and want to do. We've had some customers say, yes, this is something that we would like to take advantage of.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Great. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Dale. Appreciate that. Next up is our Snow Smart early update. Kevin Labor and Johnny. Kevin.
Morning, John. Morning, commissioners. Wonderful to be with you this beautiful day. Kevin Labor, Program Director for the Snow Smart Program. I'm here with Josh Heath, who's our principal engineer and one of our project managers within the program. Last update was in March. Today's purpose is to provide a quarterly update of work that's taken place over the last 3 months for you to share with you today and just keep you informed on the current status of the program and what next steps that we have. We'll cover the following items this morning. We'll talk about our relationship with the Department of Energy, progress that we're making with them in our partnership. Program level updates. We'll talk about the, remind everybody of the big three benefits that the program is delivering. Provide a supply chain updates. Good news on that John Heath will be sharing. And also share the distribution automation updated map of installations that have taken place. So our Department of Energy partnership. So again, as a reminder, we had a $30 million award from them. This is accelerating work that we planned on doing out in the field from 20 years down to a 5-year time frame. A couple things have happened in, about a year ago, we received what was called a data request. So all of the GRIP grant recipients received this data request, which was asking for very thorough information, basically, I would say a reapplication for these grants to revet them. And so it wasn't until earlier this year we received notification that we were approved and accomplished that data request purpose. And so we were able to move forward. And during this whole time, we've been receiving reimbursements anyway. So felt like things were positive there, but this was the final indication of that. We also had something new start this year. It's a go, no go meeting. So they have every March will be with Department of Energy to review the past accomplishments over the past year, how we've met milestones and such. And so we had that meeting in March of this year, and we received approval post that meeting to continue on with the program, of course. And again, no interruptions in our reimbursements during that time or in the work itself. So to date, we've received coming close to $6 million, so $5.7 million, and we have pending reimbursements, $300,000 for April work, and May work just got approved. That's several hundred thousand dollars. We also received some positive comments from the Department of Energy in our we have a meet with them every 2 weeks. And during our early June meeting, they reiterated how important this program is to them. And they love the work that we're doing. It's very supportive of their goals. And so we were happy to hear about that. And we're sure that the goals that we have in the program helped us out with that data request approval that we did receive. Also, they were quite excited that we had been invited. So Aaron Sweeney was able to get us invited to speak at the Northwest Public Power, NWPPA, annual meeting a couple months ago. And we were able to review the progress of the program there. And Department of Energy was quite excited that we were sharing this information. And we did note that the Department of Energy was supporting this program too. And so they want to encourage us to continue to voice that out within the utility industry. Our budget spending to date, actual spend for this year, $4.5 million. Our budget for this year is $14 million.
And we're actually seeing two things happen. We're actually seeing spending more of that. It's not additional spending. It's just accelerating some of our spending from 2027. We are, John Hughes going to be talking about some good news around the equipment. Hopefully I'm not sharing too much about that. All right. Sorry, John. Anyway, but we're seeing our installations accelerating this year. So we'll see much more spending, planned spending, taking place throughout the rest of the year. Original budget for the program, $74.2 million, and we're projected to be $1 million over at this time. This is same news as we shared last two updates around additional scope items that we added to the project.
What's the big tab? PRC baseline.
So the new tax, so that is the Washington State tax, the 10% sales tax, basically. So for work that was previously not taxed in the for this type of work, now the this type of consultant work is taxed. And so that was an additional cost that we had to add on to our contract. It is. Our advanced distribution management system project right now is still on schedule. We're starting up our factory acceptance testing right now. The test cases, test plans have been put together to date. Configuration work is taking place. And so making good progress in that project. Also, Travis Olson leading this project as a senior project manager has been doing a great job. Letting future users of these systems know about the applications that they'll be working with. So working with operations, working with field crew, helping them to see the future applications that they'll be working on and bring them in on the discussions and decisions on how to use this and how to configure this software also. So what we're excited about is if users start using it, they'll be very familiar with it already. And this is just our overall program schedule, still blurred into our program, a lot of work still to take place through towards the end of 2029. And just as a reminder, our big three benefits are reduced outage time. So this will be the installation of smart equipment that will help operators have better visibility. Working with the AMI meters, being able to decrease the breadth of outages and the duration of outages. Our decreased wildfire risk, those are those smart devices, the reclosers that we'll be installing in the field, that will be able to remotely set to wildfire settings during red flag warning events. This will save up a lot of time instead of having to go out there manually to set them to those settings. And then improved grid efficiency. This is our ability, again, working with those AMI meters, be able to decrease the level of voltage delivered to customers. Still, they're usable. They won't be able to notice the change. But temporarily doing that during peak cost times for energy and then resetting those to normal levels after those periods. Okay, so John Heap will now share with us some of the work that we're doing to reach these benefits. All right, first of all, any questions?
I did have a question. Yes. On the last slide, 8. I was reading your presentation. Why are we saying that it will result in reduced cost? Is that because it wasn't included? Because we don't know how much that wasn't included in the original business plan.
Yeah, we do.
To justify that.
Right. Yeah, there are reduced costs that are in here. The outage time, there's reduced costs for customers, of course. And there's ways of measuring that. And we're not articulating.
Right, but we didn't include it in the original code benefit.
Yeah, we have.
Sometimes we do and sometimes we don't want to.
I think we included the grid efficiency part of the costing.
Yes.
I think it was like 2% or something.
Yeah, for the outage times, one thing that we did, John did a study on, is looking at other utilities and did a test case for one part of our grid to show that we would have, rather than cost, it's reduced times, that we're looking at 20 to 25% decrease in outage time. And then the improved grid efficiency, you want to talk about that one, John? Okay, this is a good transition point right here.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, John Heap, Principal Engineer and Distribution Automation Project Manager. To answer the question a little bit about some of the financial benefits that come with this program, it really is mostly coming from that improved grid efficiency portion of the benefits. And that is kind of being accomplished through our demand voltage reduction program. And so Kevin kind of described that as like during those peak times, cooling off our grid, running a little bit lower voltage, and that should reduce the amount of power and energies that's used during those times. During the original application phase, remember, we had a different BPA product, we had a different environment, and at that time, the 20-year benefit was in the $50 million range of benefit was the estimation. Under the new environment, those updated numbers, I think we're in the $20 to $30 million benefit over the life of the program. Those are all estimates, you know, as we as we get this equipment deployed, start doing it over, we'll understand what those will be, what we have for now.
If also, if I recall, there was some benefits such as monitoring and regulating voltage at the very end of the line, so all the time, able to adjust that.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. There are some portions of our grid that are kind of at the very edge of the system where our existing operations, we don't have the visibility, right? So, A, we're getting AMI meters, we're getting that visibility, but now our operators will have the ability to control and actually address the problem from the control center, as opposed to sending someone out there. And, partially, yeah. Okay. So most of the presentations we've talked about from the infrastructure perspective have been focused on reduced outage time. Those are our big reclosers that are kind of used for reconfiguring the grid. I'm excited to come here today to talk a little bit about the other two parts of the infrastructure. So first one up, sorry, a little tree in the background here on this picture, but this is an example of one of the single phase reclosers that is installed on our system. This was a device that was installed as part of the demonstration, make sure that the equipment works as expected. Go ahead.
Where is it?
I know, it's tough to see.
I know there's a ball there.
Green arrow.
Green arrow's pointing right to it. It's kind of tough to see.
Well, I didn't see that.
We have to work with what we got. We have two on our entire system right now. So this was the better. And it serves an important John H. customer, I think, this particular recloser. So we have a couple in the field. The intent is that we're going to install about 80 of these devices across our system, largely in the wildfire areas, and they will be communicating with our ECC system via the SCADA system that we're building as the sister project, right? So that equipment, the commission approved a purchase in February, and it should start arriving in the September-October timeline. So in that interim time, we've been doing our prep work for updating our system standards and our switching and clearance procedures and training the different teams on how these are supposed to work. So super excited that that's gonna really kick off in September, October of this year. We've got a handful of projects that are in the engineering phases with the expectation we'll have projects ready to go when that equipment starts arriving. The expectation is kind of a 15-month deployment of these devices. And how they're going to be used is during wildfire season, there will be
remotely control to change how they react to problems on the grid, as well as during kind of the most critical times, those red flag warnings that we might get from Department of Natural Resources. They could go into what we have termed the red flag warning settings, which is the most aggressive, fastest acting type of control. In addition, they will provide flexibility to our operators. So if, for example, if a emergency happened downstream of one of these devices, the operators could quickly open that device, de-energize that line for safety, for emergency personnel, as opposed to today where they might have to open a breaker at the substation and take out 1,000 customers. Now it might be 50 customers. So, really excited about this new device. Still some fine work needing to be doing our GIS systems and how it'll show up in display, but we should be ready here in a couple months. Any questions on those? Okay. The third leg of the infrastructure program is retrofitting our voltage control equipment. So here is a picture. We're all awake. Thank you. So this is an example of what's called a voltage regulator on our system. And this is the equipment that's really designed to either raise or lower the voltage on the lines to make sure that we keep our voltages within range for all of our customers. So the effort that we're going to be doing, there's a green line pointing at three boxes on that pole. The work and scope of this project is to replace those controllers right there with a new device accomplishing the same function, but has a radio and communications capability so that our operators can now see what the voltages are on either side of those devices and take control to make sure that the voltage is correct on the other side of the device. Long term, that will be controlled by our ADMS system to optimize the voltage across our system in a kind of real-time fashion. Okay.
Real-time fashion, originally. I can imagine in the middle of the night, even different solution.
And that is done today. These devices are constantly acting, but with like a local visibility.
Okay.
But when they communicate to the system, now you get the whole grid so you can coordinate across devices. A little bit more efficient. So the all-important map of where we're planning on putting devices, the number of dots represents about half the devices we're going to deploy across this whole system. We're still doing design work in the Lake Stevens and kind of middle of the map, but we focused on the maybe more difficult to permit locations along highways and edges of our system where communications may not be as strong. But the blue is planned and green is complete. So I think as of today, we have 58 of these devices that are communicating and commissioned in our existing SCADA system, and kind of more are coming on. Well, so keep on updating this map. And ignore that one in Mukilteo. That's actually at our operations center. It's a test device. So, all right, a little bit about numbers and schedule. The designs were on pace. The three-phase recloser that project has been struggling with supply chain issues for many, many months. In the last couple of months, we've switched from supply chain problems to, oh no, we have so much equipment, we need to figure out where to store it. So we will be having discussions with the 75th about the 75th Street property. That'll work. New thing since our last update is the single-phase recloser line and the voltage regulator line. We've got projects that are started, nearing, and we're really working on getting those ready when we get equipment in the next.
See the yellow. It's a green on track. Yellow behind the sketch.
Yes. We're not there yet. I'm hoping that that red will turn to yellow shortly.
Okay, thank you.
So next steps in the coming months, as of this week, the ADMS system has started their factory acceptance testing. So there's folks all across the operational technologies and IT teams that are testing out those new systems. So servers have been installed, the wiring has been completed, the software has been initially configured. So they're testing all of that stuff right now. We'll be receiving our wildfire and voltage control equipment, and then Evan and maybe probably Travis will be coming back in September to give an update on the overall project. That's what I have. We're happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Another question I have is, how do capacitors banks reduce outage times?
They do not. But they will help with the voltage control.
Because then your benefits, it says, reduce outage times.
Should just be improved grid efficiency. Thank you.
Thank you. Great presentation. All right. That works.
Excellent, John and Kevin. All right, next up in our last presentation is the BPA Tech Transition Update for Lamar and Marine Works. Morning again.
Good morning again.
Morning.
Garrison Moore, I'm the Senior Manager of Power Supply. I'll be joined by Marie Morrison, who's a power analyst in our department. And I want to be mindful of the time. I know it's been a long meeting to date. And so I'm planning to, you know, instead of talking fast, maybe condense down a little bit. But please do let me know if you have questions. And we will move through this slide. This presentation is in response to commission discussion on April 29th, where there was interest in hearing more about how the BPA products are going, how billing works, and what the PUD is doing in response to this new framework. Well, success to me looks like the commission walking away with some key findings that we are outperforming our cost savings estimates that informed our decision to make this change. So we're about double the cost savings we expected, and I wanna walk through that. We also wanna share that the cost variance reduction reduced volatility in power supply costs. We're seeing that in the data. Marie will walk through that. I'll walk through the bills for BPA Power and BPA Transmission. I'm sure the commission knows how they work, and also what we're doing to make sure that those bills that we receive as Snohomish PUD are as low as possible so that our customers get the lowest possible price on their electricity. Last, we'll talk a little bit about the things that we're doing to support these products and the things that we're planning as next steps that will be important for us to get good outcomes. We're a little bit different than many other load following customers in that we have a lot of resources relative to our peers. So we do have more obligations and more work that we need to do in power supply to be successful. And we are being successful. So let's walk through it. And just wanted to remind the commission about the context of the product transition review. I won't get into too much of the details here out of respect for everyone's time, but we did do a four-month study to decide if we should switch products. And that four-month study included four different studies. Three were quantitative, one was qualitative, and we switched from the block slice power product to the load following power product. And we also switched from the point-to-point transmission product to the network transmission product. So those are the changes that we'll be talking about. Those changes also required us to rebalance our portfolio. We did sell some surplus transmission. We also sold some surplus generation resources that brought some new revenue through the door. When we did that analysis, And these are the key takeaways. One of the things that we expected was that we would have cost savings over the next 3 years of about $13 million relative to the block slice and point-to-point products. We now think that that'll look like about double that, so an additional $14 million to a total of $27 million in cost savings, something that we're really proud of. It's something that we'll talk about more. That's just the next 3 years. We anticipate additional cost savings beyond that. Marie will talk about the budget variance, much lower than what we've experienced in the past, within 4.1%. We'll also mention that that is 4.1% lower, just the right direction to be 4.1% off. And that we've established some great cross-functional and collaborative processes with peer departments for managing those resources, including the generation department. Many of the folks that you talked to today, there's some tie-ins with bill optimization there and the emerging technology group. I'm going to focus on the drivers on this slide rather than repeat some of the details of some of those findings I discussed in the previous slide. And I want to talk about the why of those updated cost savings expectations. So when we did the initial analysis over the next 3 years, we weren't sure what the market was going to be like for some of those surplus transmission and surplus generation assets. So we were a little bit conservative there. We were also a little bit conservative in the cost estimates for some of the things that we just hadn't experienced yet, and Bonneville hadn't experienced with their customer at our scale. And that was largely the resource support services, which I'll show you on a bill, in which pertain to the costs and the credits for integrating resources that a customer owns. A summary statement would be that the market for the resources that we were marketed was really good, and we far exceeded our expectations for the revenue through the door, which was a great thing, and a credit to our staff for the really wonderful way that we positioned those resources to the market, created a competitive environment for those resources, and we're able to follow through and execute all of those transactions. As you recall, there's probably 80 or so individual elements that needed to be signed and approved through the course of that. It was a lot of work. On the resource remarketing side, we thought we might wind up with a $1 million annual cost. We're seeing now that's more likely to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 to $4 million in net credits. And we'll talk through that, but those are really the drivers for what those cost savings look like. So let's get into the bill itself. And boy, this is a busy one on the left side. So I'm going to encourage everybody to take a look at that right side. And those are really the headline statements that I want folks to understand. And I also want to talk about how some of the good work that PUD staff is doing can be captured in some of these items. So the first one is where most of the bill costs roll in from the BPA power bill, 80 to 90%, depending on the month. And these are costs that are based on our forecast load across the year. That rate is reflective of our share of the federal system. We're about 10.85% of that. That means we get 10.85% of those composite charges. And we also get 10.85% of BPA's forecast secondary market revenue, which is the non-sliced charge. So that's our share of BPA, their wholesale market revenue. Now, this did not move within the year. Where this moves is in the policy environment, where BPA has rate cases that our team shows up so well in to advocate for our customers, as well as in items like litigation. We talked before about TransAlta and how that could show up potentially as a cost. You know, those are items that can make their way into composite costs. The other charges on down the list on the right side, those are charges and credits that show up within the year, and they can move based on what our load looks like and what our resources look like within that year.
The first large item are the load shaping charges. You can see HLH and LLH. HLH is the heavy load hours. LLH is the light load hours, largely overnight and on Sundays. And you can see the rate there. That's about $45 a megawatt hour on the HLH side, $49 on the LLH side. This refers to if our load exceeds our share of the federal system in a given month. This bill is for February. We pay a little bit more for Bonneville to source that extra energy. If it's less than our share, then we get a credit. So you can see this particular month in February, a little bit of a charge there.
Yeah. So is this where the battery storage project in Arlington, where we see that 45?
Yeah, I love that you are calling that out. It's exactly right. It is one of the value streams of the battery is being able to move energy or shift load from an LLH period to an HLH period, if that is the most economic thing for us to do. But I'll also explain that in some months, it's not. And I'll show you why that may be the case. That actually has to do with the next most important line item, which is the demand charge. It's a very weird charge. This is a capacity charge. You might think it's based on our peak load within the month, and it mostly is. But there are some deductions off that highest load hour within the month that reduces it. One of those deductions is the contract demand quantity. That is just a volume of capacity we do not have to pay for, free capacity. So that gets taken off that total. The other, and this is germane to the battery, is our heavy load hour average load. That also gets subtracted from that system peak load within the month. So, and we'll talk about this in the next slide, the battery can also reduce our costs, our charging during HLH hours, where that's cost effective, because it reduces the gap from our peak hour of load and that HLH average load. And we pay for that delta. So that's another way that the battery can help us there. Resource support services. I'm going to be very brief here. These are just charges to integrate our resources into load service. They are net credits for us, largely because of Jackson. In most months, because Jackson typically outperforms its firm planned energy output, and we get financial credits for that.
So does this inform us of what our value on Packwood Street is going forward? Does this help us understand that those still assets make sense for us to have?
It does. The resource support services is part of the effective cost of those resources. So we have our cost of owning and maintaining Jackson, for instance, and the contract cost of Packwood. So it's one element of that. The resources that are in that stack will be part of that stack and provider of choice just because of the way that that contract works. And they are low-cost resources, so we're glad they're there. But it's part of how we would evaluate any candidate resource as well. So this is our bill. This is February. You know, if you're sitting in our seats, you know, the first question is, well, what can we do about it? How can we make it as low as possible for our customers? That's this next slide. What are our opportunities? You've heard some great things today, and we've talked about the battery. So we can reduce that demand charge line item, right? That's one thing that we can do. The battery can do that. You know, Shane and Chris and Doug and Nick talked about some demand response programs. They can also do that, and that's a terrific thing for us. It's both that demand reduction and that HLH to LLH shifting. And we're laser focused on that, and we know what things can help us reduce those bills. Jackson's credits are based on monthly energy output. Because it's got the reservoir, we also have the ability to shape
which months that generation happens within reason and within, you know, our license constraints. Our generation group does an amazing job at working with us to optimize when we do that and seasonally allocate that fuel for the best impact for our customers. Last, and Commissioner Logan brought this up, there's some energy arbitrage opportunities. So where the prices differ, we also have an opportunity to shift load into the lowest priced batch of hours there. So those are opportunities on the power side. We're working on those with all of our friends and partners here in the room, and we're really excited about where we're headed. Transmission bill, thankfully, a little simpler. And we'll talk through this one as well, largely using those boxes on the right. This one is interesting because the MT service charge appears very similar to the demand charge, but it's different. So it is based on our peak load during a specific hour, but it's not our highest load of the month necessarily. It's based on our load when BPA's transmission system is experiencing its greatest peak. Some months, as we've reviewed our bills, our peak and BPA's transmission system peak can be as much as 12 days apart. So they are not necessarily the same evening, the same day, even the same week. So it makes it harder for us to forecast when that regional system peak might be, which is why a lot of our current efforts are focused more on reducing power side demand charges and less on targeting these transmission cost savings. Though as we get better, we think we'll have a good shot at that too. We're also receiving some credits for the transmission we are not using. Those resources inside our service territory, Jackson, Young's Creek, those types of resources, they get that short distance discount, which is reducing this bill. And then there's ancillary services here, which are largely balancing authority type services that we're getting from BPA and paying on this transmission bill. So relative scales, we just looked at a bill that was, you know, $22, $23 million on the power side. This is the same month. This is about $3.3 million on the transmission side. So we're focused more on the power side, but we're working on both of them. It really is, you know, that demand billing determinant, that peak hour that we experience when BPA experiences their transmission peak. That's the opportunity for cost savings. So as we get better at forecasting that, as we grow our tools that can address that, we have the opportunity to reduce those costs for our customers. That is where I will make the handoff to Marie. What I hope you've heard is, you know, what we thought would happen has happened. This transition has been a good thing for us, and we've exceeded expectations. Hope you have a better understanding of the bills. Welcome any questions at the end if you have those. Marie's going to talk about the budget and how that's looked.
Good morning, Commissioners. Marie Morrison, Power Analyst in Power Supply. This slide is just a high level of where we were and where we are right now, and hopefully where we're headed. So this is not a view of the BPA Power and Transmission update yet, but this is a high level view of the power supply budget. So we want to show you in 2024, we were still block and slice customers. So we thought that that was a good comparison to show you in this transition update. And then we're going to show you where we're at now in 2026. So in 2024, the adopted power supply budget was almost $348 million. And if you remember the MLK holiday, that was a big market purchase year for us. So that year we spent almost $40 million in our power supply budget. So that was before the product transition. In 2025, we knew that we were changing power products, but that change is only applicable for the fourth quarter of 2025. And so we tried our best to capture that change in the power supply budget, and we came up with $366 million in the adopted budget. Well, the actual power supply results that year came in with almost 27 million savings, and a high and big part of that was the block slice closeout. We got some credits from BPA, some savings from BPA because of that change in the power product. If you remember, there was a big slice adjustment, slice to a credit that we got, and so that all contributed to a good financial year for us in terms of the power supply budget. And now in 2026, our adopted budget was $360 million. And as of the first quarter of 2026, we're seeing savings of approximately $3 million to the end of the year. So that is just to show you, we had block and slice in 2024, and now in 2026, we have the load following product, and so far we're seeing savings from that transition. So Garrison really set me up for this slide. If recall the previous slide, that was the whole budget, but this one is just the BPA power supply budget. So the power supply budget has many components, as you can imagine. 81% of that budget is the BPA power and transmission budget. Garrison already pointed out the details of the power and transmission bills, so I'll just talk about the changes from the budget to the actual. The first two line items are fixed charges. They are fixed every single month. And then we go to the variable line items. The first one is load shaping. Here we see higher load shaping charges, and that's mostly because our loads came higher than the system shape load, as Garrison had already mentioned. But he also mentioned that we're trying to make improvements so that we can better capture the savings there. And then the second variable item is demand. As you already heard, these are capacity charges. And you're seeing here that actuals are really better than what we budgeted for in this 7-month history now with the load following product. So we feel good about that, but we'll keep on improving our assumptions when it comes to demand. We have the battery coming, so we'll also put that in our assumptions. And then the last variable item that we see here is resource support services credit. Our PUD hydro has performed better since the beginning of load following compared to the planned amounts that we have in the contract. And so what you're seeing is savings here of approximately 2.5 to 3 million because PUD Hydro has been performing better. When we budgeted for resource support services, we really didn't know how this would work in the load following product. We didn't have any history of it, but we had conservative assumptions, and we're happy to see that those assumptions are working well. But I've mentioned this twice already, we'll keep on improving those assumptions in the next budget cycle. So for BPA power alone, we're seeing 4.7% better than what we have in the power supply budget, even after the financial reserves policy surcharge, which we started getting starting December of last year. So all in all, we're really happy about that. There's really no material change from the budget. And if at all, the change is for the better, the savings that we're seeing. Transmission costs, there's hardly any movement there. We feel good about the way we're seeing our transmission actuals as compared to the budget. So in the 7 months of experience that we have with BPA load following and BPA network transmission, we're really happy that we're seeing these savings and hopefully more to come. Any questions so far? So we really couldn't do it alone. Power Supply has partnered with our friends in generation and natural resources, because with a low quality product comes different responsibilities compared to block slides. We have been having these weekly meetings with generation and natural resources to plan ahead for the week that will be, so that we know how to manage our PUD hydro resources. So we feel good about what we have set up so far. Going forward, we know we will have our battery, and we're already doing work to schedule that battery and working with emerging technologies to tighten that up when the time comes when we have the battery in our PUD portfolio. So all in all, good working relationships with our partners, with generation, natural resources, and emerging technologies. Next, a lot of work has already been done, but the work is not done yet. There's still more work to be done. We are still highly engaged in the provider of choice implementation processes. We continue to work on refining our IRP. You heard about the Peak Assist Program and Flex Ready for Business, covering both residential and businesses to contribute to our goal of serving our customers with the lowest cost of energy. We're doing that. That is not lost on us. And then we also want to learn to better understand how we interface with a market that's evolving, that's already right in our footsteps, through BBA or through other means. There's more learning to be had there. So those are the things that are in the pipeline for us. We thought that it's a good opportunity to show the commission how we fared from October through May, the latest that we have for you in terms of the budget and actual.
Any questions? Great presentation. So there are only three bullets, but there's a lot in all three of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good job, guys.
Yeah.
Very decision.
Very decision.
Good decision.
Which was really the gist of the presentation to demonstrate that was a good decision. And this doesn't really even get into, again, one of the bigger issues was the reduction in risk that we had to optimize.
It is fascinating looking at that bill. Here we are, the largest public utility in the nation. That's higher than $55 in our bill.
Yes.
So someone's got a 50 cent or a 10 cent
bill. Excellent. Well, that concludes the presentations for this morning.
Okay, next up is item 5, our RTO General Manager Report. Do you have a lengthy report for us?
I don't have a lengthy one, but I have some good items to share. First, from our IPS and cybersecurity group, Amy Wang and Kevin Johnson recently presented Trends in Energy Industry Cybersecurity at both the University of Idaho Energy Executive Program and the Energy Executive Summit.
These highly regarded programs bring together energy leaders from across the United States, including electric, natural gas, and nuclear organizations, to learn, collaborate, and share perspectives on the challenges and opportunities facing the industry. Each year, a cohort of approximately 60 leaders representing 35 to 40 organizations in every major functional area of the energy sector participate in the program. Haley and Kevin's presentation helped advance industry knowledge on emerging cybersecurity trends and reinforce our organization's commitment to thought leadership, innovation, and the security of critical energy infrastructure. From corporate communications, thank you to Commissioner Logan for driving the 1936 service truck in the Arlington Parade on the 4th of July. This weekend, we will be at Lake Stevens Aquafest with a Vactor truck in the parade and the 1936 service truck at the Sultan's Shindig. At these parades, flyers are shared about public safety power shutoff and the community energy run. In our community services group, our energy services team facilitated the energy auditor training the week of June 22nd for the state's Inflation Reduction Act program. The program includes rebate for energy efficiency, home improvements in low and moderate income households. While this program will be administered to a third-party organization, Energy Services has been active in getting training and information to our network of auditors and contractors to help ensure program success. And just to inform the commission, the Team Beauty Wellness Camp Challenge for July is injury prevention and mobility. Move better, feel better. From July 8th through the 29th, employees are asked to focus on intentional mobility training for injury prevention, logging at least one 10-minute mobility session during the challenge. Happy to answer any questions on any of those topics or anything else that's on your questions list. For John,
I don't have any questions, but Commissioner Altamirano Crosby, do you drive a clutch? I think he gets to do it all.
Well, I never learned. That type of bitch man. No.
They're looking to put an automatic.
Oh, they can't do that.
They're looking one, a vintage one.
Yeah.
Not vintage 1936, but I think from. But I will say, so I own a 1999 Ford pickup for many years with a command. Drove it in the same parade. I will say the 1936 Ford truck is a lot easier. Right. The clutch and 11 brakes. It's a nice little gear. It's really hard to stall out. No, I wouldn't drive it fast. But.
Well, I'm good. How would you do it? It's just, you know, I was hoping maybe you would be.
I wish and I would love to.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if I could get somebody to start it.
Well, I had a sort of transportation bed come, and it is a little strange. You start it with a button on the floor.
On the floor?
On the floor, yeah. So there's like an extra pedal on the floor to start it. But it runs really easy. And then he didn't mean to do so. I invited him to sit with me in the truck. And there was a squirrel they leave in the truck. I don't know if it's zip or zap. Didn't have glasses. Anyway, he rode down the parade with a squirrel on his lap. All right, next, let's move to item six, public hearing action. 6A, consideration of a resolution declaring a portion of certain rural property in the district located at 183-06 62nd Street Northeast Elmish, Washington, to be surplus and authorizing sale and transfer of the property. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
I will now convene a public hearing. We have Marine Barn Bill to answer any questions. First, I'll ask, are there any comments from the public on this resolution? Please raise your hand. There in the room. I see no hands in the room. See no hands online. Commissioner, do you have any questions or comments?
No, we were briefed in our last meeting.
I have none.
I'll close the public hearing. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed. Next, item seven, item for individual consideration. 7A, consideration of a resolution authorizing the Chief Customer Officer, Customer and Energy Services, the Public Utility District Number 1 of Stonehenge County, to execute a low income weatherization and energy savings agreement with the Opportunity Council, I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Okay. Ms. Welch is available to answer any questions. We've been briefed on this in the prior meeting. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
No, I have a very thorough briefing.
Okay, I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Next is 7B, consideration of a resolution amending the district's customer service regulations of electric service. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Okay. With Ryan Newby available, answer any questions regarding this resolution? Are there any questions?
Resolution. I have no questions.
I didn't do that. Pretty straightforward, though. I have no
question. Okay. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Next is item 8, commission business. Today's commission reports. Are there any reports?
I have none.
I have none.
Yeah, well, Commissioner Altamont Crosby and I were able to go to the public park. Really interesting presentation. Really interesting presentation from the three rating agencies. It was pretty fascinating. And to understand where we sit, I think it was S&P had a histogram. And we're in the AA and the AAA. There's only five in all public power. And I think they're threshold to that. Well situated. It was also very interesting to understand process what their fears are for our sector and also the strength of the PUD model opposed to municipal models or things like that. Because one of the fears obviously is that you know, being able to raise revenue to be involved. Anyway, very interesting. And there are some other good presentations, risk management. Okay. Anything else on commissioner reports? Next, we'll look at the commissioner event calendar. Are there any changes to the event calendar? Event calendar is one page, starts at page 169 of our packet.
See you. Oh, you're on the next page for the fair.
I am. A late fair goer. Any changes? Okay, hearing none, we'll move to item 8C, the May 2026 district dashboard that starts on page 175 of the packet. Any questions or comments on the dashboard? I don't have any, except I'm excited about the blue sky and the gray sky. I'm very interested in how that informs our work and our success. Okay. Quiet in here. Next, we'll move to page 9, our governance planning calendar. This is on page, starts on page 206. Are there any changes? Governance plan calendar.
Charlotte, financial.
What?
Financial report.
Oh,
financial
report. That I'm. AD. Oh, AD. Okay. So it still looks like district dashboard. Yeah, AD. Our 2026 financial status report, which is on page 178 of the packet. Are there any questions or comments on that?
I did like the, I don't know if it's a new graph or not, I don't have page number. There's a graph, capital forecasts, for bigger categories of work. I just like seeing it all in one.
Oh, yeah, page 6.
Hello. The page. All right. Oh, yes. I wrote over.
Good ground. No, I like this. Because capital is one of the things that is difficult sometimes to explain.
It is interesting to see programs and see the relative cost.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is one of the newer graphs to the packet.
Yeah.
I would say this, it wasn't intuitive to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Next, we'll go to our government planning calendar. Any changes to our planning calendar? I don't think we added any in today's meeting.
Would you like us to?
No, Allison's giving me a head nod. No. Is there any further business to come before us today?
I have
a well, hearing none, it is 11:34 a.m. and our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.